My name is Jerry Lindman, as maybe you've heard before me say. I'm the program coordinator here. I've been serving for a year. Holden forums are an important part of the community life. We think they provide an opportunity for conversation over important topics. They get people used to hearing differing opinions and listening, and we're not necessarily seeking a resolution out of these. We rarely do reach even a general agreement out of these sessions, but for some reason people walk away from them feeling better about the topics many times. So sometimes it's just the conversation, the exercise itself that's helpful. Tonight, the topic is entitled, It Takes a Community, the Education of Our Children. And this came out of conversation last night amongst a couple of the directors and some of the teaching staff. And I think it's an education theme this week for us at Holden anyways, especially us long-term people that have children in the school. I have two children that started school today. And that immediately, you know, dominated the discussion. And it came up that not people realize, number one, people maybe don't realize that they have a school, they do, elementary and high school, and that it's a public school. And people are surprised to learn that many times. My children back home are in a public school, we feel very good about it. But the conversation got going around the state of public schools, and people are really struggling in their communities over how they're doing, the support behind them, and there's a struggle, increasingly a struggle, just because of the demographics change that's going on. There are fewer and fewer of tax-paying citizens that have children in the school system. And the question comes to them, it must be a very big challenge many times, is, well, when is my obligation complete? When can I no longer, do I have to support that next bond issue or that millage increase? Or are there other ways to support public education? And that's kind of what we kind of got talking about. And we'd like to bring out some conversation about your communities and the situation in your areas regarding your public schools. So could we start with you, Verlin, and tell us a little bit about your
Good morning.
You had so much to say last night. About your experience with public school systems or
My kids' experience, is that what you'd like to know?
Yeah.
My boys went to school in Palo Alto, California, when I lived there for 8 years, and that's a very outstanding school system and very well financed. It's a very posh town. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of wealth in Palo Alto. And then we moved to Minneapolis and lived in the city on the near south side. And my boys went to Washburn High School. And I remember when I was, my job was to work with community colleges as part of the campus ministry staff. And all the community colleges are in the suburbs. And I remember visiting with a woman while waiting to talk to a pastor in a nearby church, and I told her my boys were going to Washburn School, and she just gasped. What? Would anybody send their kids to Washburn School? Well, she lived in a suburb, and to have my boys going to a high school in the city of Minneapolis, there are black people there. You know? It was just, I mean, you scratch it twice and it's racism. And there's an enormous problem in the financing of the public schools in the inner city. I would like if all of the Twin Cities could be one school district, but it's not. You know, Minneapolis School District and St. Paul School District, and every suburb's got a school district, or some not combined, but they're still suburbs. And they're far better off financially than the two core cities are in terms of financing their kids' education.
Because they're primarily financed by property taxes.
Yeah, and I think that's the big problem. I think we need to shift away from hooking our schools up with property tax and finance our schools through a broader financial base, like state-supported income tax, if you will.
Sales tax,
sure. Or federal support. It used to be that federal support was considered anathema, federal support for education. But that's kind of caught on now, I think. We're not quite as upset by that notion as we were.
Let me ask you, your son's experience with a very posh, well-funded school versus this urban, struggling school, how did they feel about their education? What was there challenges there in terms of getting what they needed?
They hated them. They really did.
Interesting.
They were not ready for that experience, and it wasn't very good for them.
How old were they when they transferred?
Junior high. It was a bad time to change.
Mm-hmm.
To make any kind of change, especially that kind of change.
Did they finish high school there?
No. They never finished high school, either one of them.
Mm-hmm.
I'm the proud father of two high school dropouts.
Did they then?
But they're great guys and they're doing well.
Yes.
Worried about them.
What are they doing now then, we ask?
Well, my older son is a crackerjack mechanic in the Bay Area. He runs a garage and he's making more money than I ever made. He's outstanding. My boys are adopted, so I can't take credit for their genes. I always said I have the best of both worlds. I can blame all the bad things on heredity and put all the good things to environment. And Dana never cared about anything except cars and motorcycles. He didn't even care about girls. Cars and motorcycles, races, motorcycles. He's my wild man. Wonderful guy, but nuts.
For those that just came in, we're just starting a conversation regarding the public education experience in our communities. If we have our children going there, or our experience, or whatever. So we're just kind of going around since it's kind of an intimate group. So.
My other son is like a lot of young guys trying to make his way in the world. He's married. Good marriage and three kids.
Okay.
Lives in Chanhassen, suburb of Minneapolis. Mm-hmm. We're huggers. Mm-hmm. We love each other a lot.
Good.
That's enough. That's the longest speech I've made for a long time.
Yeah, are you talking about personal experiences with school?
If you have children that have been through a system, or?
We moved around quite a bit, so we spent some time in Decorah, Iowa, then we went to Seguin, Texas for just a year, and my younger son was just entering kindergarten at that time, and I grew up out east where I had kindergarten, and Seguin didn't have public kindergarten. It was the first year. I couldn't believe it. So, and the way they did it was it was going to be full-time for half a year, and then the other half of the year, nothing. So I enrolled Steve in it was actually a Baptist church kindergarten that was okay and for that year. And then we moved up to the Twin Cities, and we ended up going into an inner ring suburb because that's the only place we could afford a house. The boys were in a good school system. In Roseville, I think it was a good system for them. And I had grown up in a town out east where, I mean, you would now maybe call it a suburb of Boston, but it was really a town, and it had a strong tradition of really good teachers and good schools. And so it was very important to me that the boys be in a good school. And I disagree a little bit on the racism issue. I think that it's the teachers and the stability of the school, the care of the teachers in the school that is attractive to people, and you can find that in the city too. You know,
sure.
if you look around at the schools. In the
you know, another interesting point. Now that you two are empty nesters, another question I guess I would like people to pay attention to is those that are empty nesters, that their children are out of educational.
No, they're not.
Well,
my older son just went back to graduate school.
Oh, there you go. But do you, does that change your perspective when on supporting your local public schools?
But I think, I mean, I agree with Verlin that there needs to be a more equitable way. Some people are talking, though, when you, and I'm not up on this, but there's some of the people, like in Bloomington, the very much more wealthy suburb, that there's, well, Yvonne talks about this, but that the suburbs that have very high income are actually funding the poor counties in Minnesota, because there are counties in Minnesota that are really poor that can't support the schools, so it comes out of the general fund of the state.
Mm-hmm.
So there is that other issue too about, you know, those people are wanting some sort of equitability. You know, property tax is not a way to do it, but there's got to be some way that's just fair to the kids.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it does distribute the money. Mm-hmm. Equally, so that even in the poor counties, they still are supported. But it's an almost welfare situation in some of the counties, mm-hmm. where the money has to come in from the state.
Mm-hmm.
It has to be general fund.
Mm-hmm. I taught in public schools for 15 something like that, and I always felt that we had very good schools. It was in Southwest Iowa. Town of about 4,000 or so, and our boys went there to school, and I think they had a very good education. Now we're living in near Milford, Iowa, and the school there is a small consolidated school, but I'm still interested in the education because my grandchildren go there, and so I don't feel like I'm ready to abandon but I have concern. It seems that, you know, in our small town there, we have a very town council that was trying to get some TIF money. And I said, what is TIF money? Well, it's evidently when there's some new development in this area, the taxes for this new park does not, you know, they can get. Well, I said, so then it's not, then the school doesn't get a share of it, and that's
right.
True.
Right.
I think that catches on, more people get to doing that, we're going to have some more troubles than we have now. This always, in this kind of a resort area where we live by the lake, there are many people that are not interested in schools, you know, and so this is great, get this TIF money, we'll get our streets all fixed up. So.
Mm-hmm. What does TIF stand for?
Tax increment financing. We live in Minnesota.
And I thought, you know, there's got to be another bad side to that too. And
I wish that states would not ever link lottery money with education.
Mm,
that's bad.
That's radio.
Because it just takes that amount of money out of the general fund that normally would go for education.
Yeah.
They just, it's the same amount of money. They're just financing it with lottery dollars instead of.
And the thought of tying gambling to that.
Well,
it's less predictable.
Well, and a lot of the people who are buying the lottery tickets are the poor parents who really can't afford to buy the lottery tickets, but they're looking for their fortune. I mean, they're paying for it anyway.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And they're thinking that they're adding money for education, and they're not getting money.
Yeah.
There's no more money.
That's a very devious angle on that. Yeah. But I think it kind of tends to be a pretty steady revenue source.
Yeah. Well, there have been problems in Minnesota, though.
Oh, have they really? Has it kind of fluctuated?
Yeah, with their estimates, because I think they were tending to overestimate. That I was in a hearing where they brought in the finance commissioner, and there was this royal battle. Because it meant that this legislative commission that takes some of that money for environment stuff didn't have the money that they thought they were going to have.
Mm-hmm.
Because they had the lottery people had a habit of over projecting what they would take in. And then, you know, if you make your budget based on that rather than on some better prediction of what the you know, revenue is going to be for the state, then, you know, somebody gets screwed.
Mm-hmm. I know in Michigan, a few years ago, there was a major reform, school financial reform implemented, and it was after decades of debate, and Michigan schools were heavily financed by property taxes. And there was a major initiative passed finally that shifted it to sales tax. They increased the sales tax by, I think, three cents. And there was a major reduction in the property taxes. It was a shift, and then there was a new formula so that those urban schools, all schools, would share more equally. But wealthy districts still can add incrementally more, so there's still more revenue. But there's more of a minimum, I guess, a higher minimum that came from the state. But they did that, and that seemed to seem to satisfy.
No, yes.
Oh, really? No? You're from Michigan?
Yes.
I didn't know that.
And we have a lottery.
Well, that's true, we do. Right. Yeah, I'm from Michigan, East Lansing. Where are you from?
East Lansing.
Alpena.
Kalamazoo.
I didn't know that.
That's good. So you don't think it's more...
Some people think it's... What's going on?
Well, I know they're getting it out of some out of the lottery.
Yes.
But, you know, what proportions, I don't know. But I know that it's working, but how long it's going to work, that's not the question.
There's a lot of concern about, well, the property tax will just sort of creep up.
It's going up.
Yeah, and that what in effect will have happened is you just had a sales tax increase.
Yeah. So we're salary tax going to the general fund?
Oh no, property tax is a locally levied tax, and it's levied by all the municipalities and the biggest chunk prior to the reform was the school district, and that shift to sales and the state level did significantly reduce the school district's reliance on property taxes.
But doesn't the sales tax hit the poor people relatively more than the people who are well-to-do? So the very well-to-do people would have welcomed that change, I would think. Mm. Rather than having it on, I would think having it on the income would be more proportionate to people's means than, I mean, a sales tax is going to be on the very basics.
It's not
there
on
was incredible debate.
Not on food.
Yeah, there's no sales tax on food. But you're right. I mean, a lot of people, and that's what held up the reform for decades, was that debate. But in Michigan, there's a constitutional provision that calls for a flat tax, income tax. So they would have had to amend that. And there was a compromise, as anything is, in the political environment. And that did shift, as you described, as you were saying, was needed from the property tax to a state levy tax. You're right, it wasn't income tax, but it's certainly a lot of years.
We have an excellent high school that my son attends, Churchill, and that's where Steve's children went too. And in speaking to the principal there, he said the problem that he sees with public education is that the community is giving it too much responsibility. The schools have too much responsibility. They have driver's training. They have to work with these young mothers and help take care of their children. They have to deal with violence and all these other peripheral issues. And so it waters down what they should be doing in mathematics and English and history and all of those other things. When we see problems with our youth, we put the responsibility for fixing it onto our schools.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Parents abdicate that responsibility.
Mm-hmm. That's interesting. After having just gotten out of Sally's session on kind of an overview of what situations with childcare these days, it's. I've heard that from a lot of teachers that I've dealt with in my son's school, my son's high school. They're just increasingly burdened with children who simply come in and not prepared emotionally, mm-hmm. socially, where they used to be. And
if you don't provide, you know, social services and put them in contact with a school psychologist or the medical help they need and provide those free breakfasts and lunches, you've got students that cannot maintain their attention in a classroom. Mm-hmm. Because they're thinking about, gee, I really need to get a job, but I can't get to driver's ed and I can't pay for, you know, that private tutoring of the driver's training, or, you know, I've got this baby that I've got to take care of. I can't get my GED. I can't go any further in my education. So as a society, we've really said, you know, the common denominator we have here is the school. It's the most efficient way to get to those kids of distributing those services. And if the reality is that the family's not doing it, what do we do?
But are you saying provost school is better than public school? And that
I don't think he said that.
My only experience with Eugene is a high school.
You know, I wanted to mention that the flip side of this also is, you know, I'm a retired teacher, and I have seen this in the public schools too, that we've been used as dumping grounds. And because we take so much time and effort and money to address the social issues of the kids in school, the ABCs are ignored.
Yes.
We are putting kids through just to move them through. They get through eighth grade, they can hardly read, they get through high school, and some of them are still reading on a fifth grade level. I mean, they just aren't getting it. They're not getting it. And so many potential kids who could go on to college just aren't making it. They can't write. They can't spell.
Yes.
They can't add.
Yes.
Basic. The ABCs. That's where the educational thing gets swallowed up. And how can we do both? I don't know. We're not equipped. Teachers are not equipped to do both.
Well, you can't when you got that many children.
Pardon?
You can't when you have that many children and you have that many problems in one room.
Right.
The mainstreaming.
Yeah, I know.
Mainstreaming is one of the things that is not good.
No, I know.
Oh, now hold it. Don't tell me that.
I think for those that who can assimilate, but there's those that are in mainstream that can't. They can't do it. They just can't do it.
My son just graduated from high school. He probably reads at about a second grade level, and he probably does math at about first grade level. He has been in special services from preschool on, mm-hmm. and he will still continue to. He functions well. He will be a contributing member to society, but part of it is because he was not pulled out, he was not excluded, he was part of a group. He taught kids in his classes what it was like to be special. Mm-hmm. They learned so much from him, and he learned so much from them. If you had isolated him, if you had pulled him out, that would have never happened.
I see I was in the educational system when this switch came around. And I think one of the biggest problems was that it was dumped on the teachers. Literally, the doors were open. All of these kids came into the classroom, and the teachers didn't have the foggiest notion on how to handle this. This was like 15, 20 years ago. There was nothing in teacher ed. Everything is done on the bell curve, and you're teaching to the middle. You're not teaching to the gifted. You're not teaching to the handicapped. You're teaching in the middle, and you've got all three in your classroom. Mm-hmm. The doors open. Mm-hmm. Everything came in, and we were just overwhelmed. And that's when all the problems, I mean, that's where most of the problems started, and we've never been able to play catch-up. I don't think that they're doing much with our teacher education classes, even today, with the mainstreaming issue.
Oh, I think they are. On the community college level, 100 level,
do
a 5-credit exceptional children.
Do they?
For every special, yes.
Is it required of every normal teacher?
Yes. At least one class, if not more. And every special needs kid that comes into that classroom comes with special federal funding because it's part of the Vocational Rehabilitation Act, that every single one of those kids comes with special services attached to mm-hmm. them. That teacher's not left in that classroom when it's a special needs kid without support. Mm-hmm. Now what happens, and the reality is there's not enough money to go around, the reality is that, you know, advocating parents that know the legal rights of those special needs kids, they'll get the services. Mm-hmm. It's the kids that don't have the advocate that won't get their piece of the pie.
Mm-hmm. But when you have 35 kids in the school in a room, and you have children that have the means, but you know, either, mm-hmm. and you may have, now I know there was a class of 8 to 35, but that ratio is too high.
Yeah, I know, it is.
You know, 35 average children probably would be, normal. It sounds rather high to me.
And there are good ways to do it in the Baptist.
Yes, that's true.
And some school systems are cutting it down. I don't think I taught in a Michigan school district outside of Kalamazoo, and I don't think our ratio was 35. I think it was like 24.
But at least with the special needs kids, there are federal bucks assigned to them nationwide.
Yeah.
Now, every district uses that federal money differently. Mm-hmm. But there are some pretty strong mandates on, you know, that it can only go for so far.
Possibly there is extra teachers now, but when they first were dumped, there just wasn't any extra federal money.
If it's anything like computerization, just in my experience in the last 2 years, with when I went home and started taking care of my two children, I picked up where my wife had been in the volunteering 2 hours a week for each of them in the classrooms. And I, at that time, the last couple of years, they, in a major way, implemented computers in the school, mm-hmm. in the elementary. And this is a well-to-do school district, too. But that really, it was very clear they had not prepped the teachers, but they expected them, here's the equipment, implement it in your curriculum, implement it in your classroom, we're going to require this. It was very clear that it was just poorly managed. And that is a problem.
Money.
Yeah, and well, I think the teachers will respond, but it will take a lot of time, a lot of grief.
Yeah,
and,
take some classes, and I know. Mm-hmm. Yeah, they tend to do that.
How do those of you who have been teachers, particularly the parents, also feel about standardized tests? Minnesota has just now put in place a standardized test system where I think it's at the 8th grade level, everybody has to pass this test in reading, arithmetic, et cetera, the basics, mm-hmm. before they can go on. And I think there's also a standardized test for high school graduation. The very thing you're talking about, Marianne, we don't want to graduate people who
can't
aren't
read.
Ready to graduate.
Yeah, right.
How do you feel about that? A lot of teachers hate it. Mm-hmm. They really hate it.
Why?
Because it's a kind of outside pressure that they're not accustomed to.
And it reflects on how well they're teaching.
Right.
Well, I suppose some who probably don't feel too self-confident about their ability might hate it for that reason.
Of course, it's not any one teacher that brings a student to 8th grade and he can't read. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's not any one teacher, because you don't have one teacher for mm-hmm. 8 years.
Yeah.
It's the school itself, or the district itself, that reflects on.
Well, it's a family, too. I mean, this reading thing is a kindergartner and a second grader, and clearly witnessed. I was in the classroom. A lot of this, we're talking about the family, where it started. What, you know, so just some basics in terms of those elements are really come out of the family, I think, in a big way. Preparing a child to read, it's a pretty basic thing. So I fault the family, too. I mean, they're in that line of fire.
Well, one of the criticisms you hear of standardized testing, of course, is that they're ethnically biased. And it's very difficult, I would think, to develop a test that does not have some ethnic bias about it.
I don't know.
Culture
that's,
bias.
That's what I don't understand. How can there be a test, a math test, that's culturally biased?
2 and 2 is 4, no matter what color your skin is, right?
Right.
Yeah. I hear what you're saying.
But I think Michigan has standardized tests.
I believe that, too.
Well, one of the educators' criticism of it is in Washington, we have it at fourth grade again at seventh grade, again at 11th, and then to get out. Is that educators teach the test. Curriculum that, as opposed to what developmentally is appropriate for the children or the whole look at the child, they teach to get those kids the highest score possible on that particular test. Whether, if it's a great test, can one little instrument dictate curriculum? I don't know if we've got that kind of genius in the test-making business. Now, really good educators don't worry about standardized tests. If they have, you know, great bunch of kids that have great support of, you know, family, and they don't get a whole lot of pressure on, you know, how do they do compared to everybody else. For the most part, good educators, they're not going to worry too much about it. It's when too much focus is placed on those funny little differences that I think that's when it gets out of whack.
Well, in many cases, too, I believe in Michigan, there's money tied to a school district's performance on those. So I guess that's really the kicker. It isn't just measuring somebody's ego, but it's actually, there's dollars on the line. And so that builds in a real incentive to, as you say, teach to the test. My brother teaches in 8 years in elementary, and he's a fine teacher, a very fine teacher, but he struggles with that issue all the time. He would love to be able to do something other than that, but it just dominates his efforts.
This is an offshoot of what we're talking about, but I want to bring in this. You talked about children and state money and how they connect. There's a certain day of the school year, right after the school starts, that there's a head count. And it depends on how many children are in the school at the time.
On that day.
And there is per capita how many students you have. I mean, if you've had a flu epidemic and half the population is home, you're in for a bad, bad year financially. And so they encourage everybody to come to school, and if you're so sick, go home after the bell rings. Then you can go home and go to bed. I mean, that is ludicrous, but it happens, and that's what you're saying too. And in this case,
yeah, the school count issue is a big deal.
Pupil equals dollars.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, that's what happens when you're talking about, on one hand, the financing should be more state financing, but that's what I witness has happened is that there is a trade-off. You get more centralized controls then, because they believe on that level that they can dictate then, if they're handing out the dollars, you lose the local control and the local influence. So it isn't all, you know, there are big trade-offs in saying shift the funding to the state. It's not my responsibility, it's not a local responsibility.
One of the things that goes with testing in Minnesota now is mandatory summer school for kids that did not pass the test,
are
required to go to summer school until they can pass the test. I don't know how you feel about that.
She has two pays.
Who pays for the mandatory summer school?
Well, there's extra money for that, apparently. Mm-hmm. I don't know about the financing system.
That might be good for two reasons. There isn't that whole 3 months in which the child sort of regresses and then has the additional help. I would say that might be a good, although I know that children need time off too, and I don't know how you can.
Are there anybody had any experience with something more than like 180 days of school, or is there's a trend I know to
year
towards year round school, and some have.
In Florida we had, they started with grade schools in Orlando, and they're adding junior highs. I think junior highs are on board now for all year round, and eventually they'll have the high schools too. And in the communities that I have been part of, it's a popular thing. Mm-hmm. They go to school for I don't know how many weeks, and then they're off for three, and then they resume again.
They tried that for 5 years. My daughter lives down there, and it's not working because of all the activities. It doesn't coordinate with
with the sports and the music and all the camps and everything. It is, and the teach and the parents don't like it because it's three on, three off, this type of thing. It's very hard with baby.
Childcare?
With care, baby, you know, cares.
Childcare.
Mm-hmm. It just doesn't work. I don't think they have it now. When was the last time that?
I left at the end of '94, and
yeah, they had it then. But she's there now. My son-in-law was teaching, and I don't think. In the district that they're at, and also if one district has it, another district doesn't have it, then the competition with all the other sportsmen never doesn't work. And they're finding a lot of conflict with that. Mm-hmm. So I think they went back to the original way. Mm-hmm. But I knew of last. I have to ask him.
But that kind of brings up another question, and that is, we've got these publicly financed buildings that sit vacant. How many hours?
Yeah, they wanted to avoid that. Mm-hmm. Of having them sit so long. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But what happened in some situations is they're still only going 180 days, but they're distributing it differently.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So what's the difference?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It was real different. It would be good for the kids, it would be good for the teachers to have too much time off, but they said I wasn't working.
Mm-hmm. Our four children went to public school, but we've been in Morris, Minnesota, for 35 years, so just the older one had been in school before we moved there. But by the time she was a senior, she was thoroughly bored, and we should have let her go to college. She could have gone if she, at this stage, she could go to the university right in town, as many do in their junior and senior years, and get college credit. And but at that time, of course, we didn't, you know. Yeah. We also have a Catholic school, elementary school, and a Baptist school through K through 12 in town, in a town of 5,600. And we have passed several bond issues. The high school didn't pass the first time. We didn't get a pool, but we will have a pool now with the university. It was passed, funded by the rest of you Minnesotans to help, but it's also school debt. Yeah. So, and we've had very good instructors. We've had people from Russia, teachers come over, and our teachers and students have been over there for 3 weeks at a time. Of course, we've had students for 3 weeks, and teachers year round teaching Russian in our school for several years. And now we've had two teachers. The one last year was high school, and the one this year was elementary, go to Japan on a Fulbright scholarship. There are two teachers from each state that go each year now, and we're very fortunate to have two from our school.
Wow.
So I think they get a good education.
Great.
Our three children had very little contact with the public schools. They were in private schools almost all of their school days. We started out in parochial school back in Valparaiso, Indiana. And then we went overseas and they attended a private, it was a British school in West Africa. And that was for 4 years. And that was a school of mixtures because it was there was a university in Ibadan, and it was all of their staff, their faculty were international, and they went to school with kids with turbans on their heads, with the national dress. I mean, talk about interdenominational kind of stuff. It was just, you know, and they didn't think of anything about, you know. The only big problem was that some of them had to take English zero because they didn't speak English, and that was the biggest problem the school had in getting them up to speed with English because it was a British school. But anyway, our kids went there, and then they came back, and being back in Kalamazoo, Michigan, actually it was Richland, Michigan, which is outside of Kalamazoo. And they went to a very, very good public school for a couple of years before we went overseas again. And Comstock is the area that we lived, and they had a new General Motors plant that had opened up there, and plenty of tax money. the school was a good school. They had no problems, you know. But our son, our one son, is gifted, and I couldn't help but relate to your daughter. He came back is in junior high, and because the British school system starts a year ahead, what we do in first grade, they do in kindergarten. And so they had had all the subjects that already, and our one son is very gifted. And the teacher didn't know what to do with him in eighth grade. He sat in the library and he read every encyclopedia from beginning to end. I mean, and this guy absorbs everything. He absorbs the most, you know, who needs that information, but he retains it. That's what he did. He read encyclopedias that year until he finally got into high school. And then the next year, we took off and went to Sri Lanka, and at that time there wasn't schooling, there wasn't high school on the island, and they went to school in India to a private school called Kodaikanal. It's a school, there's another one that is comparable to it up in the north, which is called Woodstock. And they're both American schools, American curriculum, American teachers, and they encompass all the missionary kids in those areas, the American missionaries. And so they went to school there for a couple of years, then they came back and had 1 year left, or 2 years, 1 year, and they graduated. And then they went to a private college, a Lutheran college. So our kids have had very little touch, and I haven't had much touch with the public school system except when I became a teacher, and I became involved in the teaching of the public schools. So that's our background, and I know that our kids, I mean, I can't, academically, they receive so much more than they would have in the public schools, because here in the States, because the classes were smaller, and I can't talk about the richness, because you can't compare that, because it's so rich going to school outside of your country. Of the culture that you're in, and you absorb the culture and the people around you, and there's so much there to absorb. But I would say that our kids really, I'm just really pleased with the education that they've had. I cannot complain one bit. But it was through all private agencies, and of course I'm a real firm supporter of parochial schools and private schools. So that's, being taught teaching in a public school, I have a perspective on that. Yeah.
Did you find your colleagues teaching in the public schools to be caring, concerned, dedicated teachers?
At the time that I was teaching, I've been retired 10 years.
Okay.
So this was a good 15, 18 years ago, and the answer is yes. Some of my colleagues now are retiring, and I'm hearing stories like the young teachers are coming in, and they come in at 10 minutes before the kids get there, and they leave when the school buses go. And gone are the days when they would come in early and stay late and come in on weekends to work, which is what we always did. And that just doesn't exist today, which means that you're not there for the child after school if he needs to talk to you, or you're not giving that extra.
I don't know if that's the case or not. My wife is an educator, a substitute teacher, and she keeps coming home and saying, I am amazed at the dedication of the teachers out there. She said, obviously, they're not in it for the money, because our teachers are not paid what I feel they should be.
Are you from Oregon?
Yeah. I'm a pastor. We've moved three times during the time that our children were in school. They've all graduated now. And I have to say, as a parent, that was my experience. Just, you know, extremely caring teachers. I also feel, I was the one who prayed last night for the partnership that parents and teachers have. I think we really need to encourage the fact that we don't send our children to school to do it for us, but we are partners with these teachers. They have skills and gifts that we need to help our children to learn. But that's been my experience, you know, being married to an individual. And I find that still to be the case today from my experience.
I haven't heard any discussion at all. I'm kind of surprised of vouchers, the whole voucher issue. It's in Michigan, it's been promoted.
So explain it.
Minnesota too.
Yeah.
We were governor of Texas. Best things that sliced bread.
Yeah.
Basically, it's a system by which every eligible student would be eligible to receive what basically a voucher, and they could, that represents a certain amount of money per year, and they could choose where they want to go. And in its most wide open theory, it's you can take it to a private school also, and the state would reimburse.
Including a parochial school.
Including a parochial school. Now that has not, it's just been talked about, well, it's been hotly debated for a long time in Michigan, and the closest thing that has been adopted in Michigan is this charter school concept.
Yeah, we got that. That's publicly funded, though.
Yeah. But it gets, yes, it's publicly funded. It gets at the issue. It's a more, it's a competitive model, basically, to allow people to basically set up a school within a school district or near a school district or whatever, and receive state funding. Correct. Yeah.
There are some. I don't know if it's a minor difference, but the teacher whose kids discovered the frogs—that's a charter school. And Cindy ran into trouble. There are people who come in who have some trouble. I mean, there are some of the kids are people who've had a lot of difficulty fitting into the public schools, and it works better for them to have that kind of more, you know, looser curriculum. But there was one family there who really went after her for no reason, and she finally had to go back to the public schools because the Pope public school teachers and the charter schools didn't have the same kind of liability insurance, and she was afraid that this father, who was so angry at her, would file a suit and they would lose their farm. Her husband owned a farm right nearby.
Wow.
So she went back to the elementary school, and she's all hot on this, this new kind of package learning. Is that they're, I forget the word for it, maybe you know, where they have projects. They learn around a big project over a period of time. She was kind of pioneering in that. But, I mean, it's just that even though it's publicly funded, apparently there are some differences.
In our area, we were encountering homeschoolers whose parents want the children to come in for certain things, be it sport, music, whatever, just those things. And our district has said that they will pay for these various things.
Interesting. Wow. The homeschoolers will pay?
I don't know if you're aware that Washington has the highest rate of homeschooling in the United States.
Where's that?
Washington State has the highest rate of homeschooling in the entire nation.
Well, we've kind of got two factors working there. One is that I think we have quite a few kind of counterculture folks, but we also have, at least in Whatcom County, a very strong fundamental Christian group that are very much opposed to any state-mandated or state-controlled education. They don't even want student learning objectives agreed to district by district, because they want to have full control over what's taught regarding the origin of life, regarding censorship of books, and they figure if their dollars attached to, you know, they're going to lose control. So they would much rather have control on a local basis.
But they would be okay with the school involving sports, and you know, you're talking about selected things that aren't curriculum, music or sports.
I haven't heard that request from our
really?
No.
in Iowa.
But these people,
they all come in Iowa. The school has many.
Do they pay the fee then?
I don't think so. I don't know.
These people, though, are still paying property taxes.
Sure.
So they're funding the public schools.
Right, they're paying.
No, now, you're
just like Prokill.
Yeah,
just
like Prokill.
How do they feel about that? I mean,
well, they're willing to do it.
They are.
They're willing. They don't have to do this. You know, they can go to a public school.
People without kids.
You have that choice.
Well, that's true.
People who've never had kids pay property taxes, support schools.
Yeah.
But they're also hiring the people that are graduating from the school system. I mean, as a whole culture, we benefit from a higher.
Yeah, it makes the community a better place.
Right.
Yeah, it's a community benefit.
Oh, nobody has spoken to the voucher thing, so I want to. I think the vouchers are a very, very bad idea. I think they undercut the public school. And here, the question you raised in your written material for tonight as to whether the support of the public school is part of our Christian responsibility, I'd say yes. The public school has been the agency through which this country historically has become a nation, and E Pluribus Unum has found its oneness, and we start dismantling the public school, and I think we're chipping away at some very important stuff in this country. That's subtle but important. And I think the voucher thing is going to do that if it becomes widespread. And there are people in Minnesota who want it. And a lot of people who want it are Roman Catholics because they have their schools, and fundamentalist Christians because they don't like public schools at all. And those two groups are very strong. So I think we need to be vocal in our support of public schools and against vouchers. That's how I feel, politically speaking.
And I would agree. I think it becomes very elitist, not only economically, you know, that those that appreciate the education pay the additional amount to make it work at the private school are siphoned off, but also those families that are most supportive and most concerned about their child's education are going to be funneled off.
That's right.
And you no longer have the mix in the classroom where we're all learning from, you know, each other. Mm-hmm.
Well, you do have that dilemma, though, of, as we had heard about, what happens when you're dealing with a school district that just does not perform well. It's a monopoly. And the children, you know, do you want your children to have to go to school there? Is there a choice in the matter? Not just religiously, but, you know, just practically speaking, we have schools that just aren't performing. How do you do that? Do you give them more money? I think a lot of people say no, that's not the case.
Well, I don't think we get schools to perform through competition. It's not like making Levi's. It's a very different.
That certainly is the part of the element of it. Yeah, a voucher is a competitive set up.
That's the argument we need. That's the our government argument is we need to have some competition for these public schools, and then the public schools will improve. I just don't believe that. I don't think that's the dimension. I don't think that's going to work. That's a dream.
Do other states have open enrollment where they can go to a neighboring school if they want?
Always does.
I know
you can do that
in our school district.
You don't have to go to the neighborhood school.
But with the declining population, our schools are getting smaller. And fewer people, you have, you know, larger farms, they're not making money either.
Right.
And the economic situation is not good.
Interesting. That's true in the rural and small town areas. It's not true in the inner city.
Yeah.
No.
It's in the suburbs.
We have a Lutheran school, and I haven't heard much in our parent-teacher association meetings. Parents aren't pushing for vouchers. And that's interesting. But we don't have a large school either.
Our grandchildren go to a local school in Fullerton, California. and they were relatively small up until a couple of years ago. They have, it's grade K through eight, but they didn't have as much enrollment as the city wanted them to have to, I don't know what it was. Anyway, they were short about 40 students. So anyway, they opened up the doors for some new enrollment. They put in a couple of new buildings in the back, and they're getting, I mean, people are running as fast as they can from the public schools in California, in Southern California.
Oh, really?
They're thinking, oh, there's so much crime and drugs. And parents who can afford it are all flocking. And I can't say all parochial schools, but this parochial school, it was happening. And they filled up to capacity. And they were not screening. You did not have to be a Lutheran to be part of the parochial school. Well, that in itself is no problem. But what is happening is that those parents are getting on the school board, and they're non-Lutheran. And they're bringing in different ideas, and they're not following the traditions of what the Lutheran Church, and pretty soon they're going to become just a private institution, losing all of their characteristics of being Lutheran. This is what Valparaiso University is facing too, because not too many years ago we accepted government support. The worst thing we could have done, but if we hadn't done it, we would have sunk, because it's a private school. And so now we have to have so many of this and so many of that, and so much of our faculty has to be black, so much of it has to be foreign, so forth, on and on and on and on. And the issue is, the big issue they studied for a whole year is, what is a Lutheran institution? What is it? You know, does a Lutheran teach 2 and 2 equals 4 any different than a public school? These are real hard things. But what we're doing, what's happening, what I'm trying to get across, is that some of these private schools that are opening up by voucher, if you will, they will lose their original identity because they are, you know, getting in different elements. And I'm not saying it's wrong to encompass,
no,
but you have to redefine who you are. That's something to think about.
But if they get what they want, they may not over time really care for it.
Yeah.
Interesting. Well, we always try to cut these off at 60 minutes, and we've had 60 minutes of good conversation, I think.
Yeah.
It sounds like to me...
have we solved
it? It's a heck of a lot better than our discussion of Clinton and Lewinsky we had a few weeks ago. But it's nice to hear that people support and feel good about their public schools, and there are definitely problems, and we all know them, but it seems like in general, where we had comments that the teachers are being asked to do too much these days, the children aren't coming in to the school system as prepared to learn as they should be. Teachers are not trained sufficiently to handle a lot of the new situations that they're being called for. And the financing, that was very interesting how much discussion we had on the financing of it, that apparently there's some real thought that that is, to secure steady financing of a public school would at least stabilize a school to some extent, and that's a very good point, but it sounds like we can all go back and enjoy our public school system.
Thank you.
Thank you.